I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 192 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. It was more than 50 years ago that this week's guest, Chris Difford, posted an ad in a London sweet shop window seeking a guitarist for his non-existent band. Glenn Tilbrook answered the call, and the two of them formed Squeeze and became one of rock's greatest songwriting tandems. Difford wrote the lyrics with a master storyteller's eye for detail, emotional and otherwise.
The cigarette puffs, gold links in my cup.
Tilbrook took the music in surprising directions, creating indelible melodies amid unexpected chord changes. I love this band. Difford still lives in England and continues to perform and on occasion to record with Tilbrook and Squeeze. He also has several solo projects under his belt. In this conversation, Difford digs into the origins and evolution of his and Tilbrook's partnership. How did they come to divide the lyrics and music writing duties? When Difford writes a song, does he suggest a musical direction to Tilbrook? Did Difford know that pulling muscles from the shell would turn out to be a rocker? Labeled with Love would be a country song, that Slaughtered, Gutted, and Heartbroken would be an old-timey shuffle.
Slaughtered, gutted, and heartbroken, with no spirit or no soul.
How did Difford and Tilbrook discover that they sound awesome singing octaves together? How did they decide on which songs Difford would sing lead?
And Davy Crockett rides around and says it's cool for cats, it's cool for cats.
Were they surprised when Hourglass became their biggest hit? Difford also discusses the impact of producers, such as John Wood and Elvis Costello, why so many keyboardists joined and left the band, and the reasons Squeeze broke up and regrouped the first time. After a long hiatus, Squeeze returned with the albums Cradle to the Grave in 2015,
say time is of the essence. They say time will always tell.
And The Knowledge in 2017. How has Difford's dynamic with Tilbrook changed? Is there tension over tackling more political topics versus Difford's vein of emotions-driven storytelling? What current project is pushing the band forward while digging into its past? Difford is a man who carefully chooses his words, and I was hanging on every one of them here. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Chris Difford. When you're writing lyrics and you're working with Glenn, how much are you saying to him, hey, you know, this is a rock song, this is a fast song, this is a slow song, this is a, you know, like how much are you shaping that aspect of it?
Not at all. From the first time we ever wrote together, there was no conversation, and there hasn't been any at all up until just recently when we've decided to kind of changed the way we write in some ways, and Glenn's been more vocal about what he feels should be lyrically said. And I guess, you know, that change has been because I think we've both grown older and have different views about where we want to be as composers, I guess. So, you know, we don't really communicate that well when it comes to writing songs, but the songs speak for themselves.
Right. So you said there's been a shift. Is that like how recent is that shift? Would that bit have been on like The Knowledge, or is that since then? Or
yeah, I think since The Knowledge, Glenn contributed lyrically to some of those songs, and you know that there was a sort of lean towards lyric writing that I'm not very good at, really, which is more sort of, I guess, not political, but more sort of vocal about the way that you feel about the way things are going. I'm more of an emotional writer, more of a writer that sort of lives in the story rather than putting together a sort of image, if you like.
That's interesting, because I was, my perception was that, like, on that album, that you'd maybe shifted your priorities a little in the way you were writing, and that you were maybe trying to tackle more topical issues. But that was really more Glenn doing that, and you sort of sticking with what you already like to do.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, when you know, or when I know what I'm comfortable writing, and if I keep to that, then I feel the reward is worth it. So you know, I'm not really a person that can sort of. I kind of struggle when I'm sort of asked to write in those kind of terms. I prefer to write about the emotional side of life.
Right. So that's something that's been consistent with you. Like, you've been doing this for decades, and you don't feel like you've shifted in the way you write all that drastically.
Not really. I mean, there are people that do it really well, and I take my hat off to them. I'm not that right. You know, I'm comfortable with the stuff that I write. You know, when I'm writing my solo stuff, obviously I have complete freedom, and I just write whatever strikes me as being something that people would like to hear.
And what's the balance with you in terms of, you know, telling stories in your songs, kind of creating characters, having characters in your mind versus, you know, channeling the emotions that you're going through and things that are maybe more autobiographical?
Yeah, well, sometimes you can create a character, and that character can travel with your feelings and your thoughts, and, you know, you can almost write the play, if you like, of your own life and disguise it by having characters sing it for you. Lots of writers do, because it is like therapy. You can find yourself expressing yourself in that kind of way. And just recently, I've been sort of dabbling in writing, not poetry, but sort of short vignettes. And that's taken me off in a completely different place.
Huh. So vignettes, like, just, and are these going to be songs eventually, or is this something else?
I'm putting it out as a book, and I'm saying to all the songwriters out there, if you want to use these, go ahead.
But you're not going to use them yourself?
No.
It's excess material for you.
Yeah.
I mean, so to go back to older Squeeze songs, like the characters in Up the Junction, do they recur in, like, Vicky Verkey, or are there certain people in your mind who are kind of jumping from song to song, and, you know, we have to sort of make the connection as listeners?
During that time, there was a community of people that I grew up with. There was lots of people that we used to hang out with and go to the pub with, and they all kind of have been transferred into some of those songs, but the stories have not crossed over. I think that would be folly for me to try and do that unless I was working on a musical, which I would love to do. But, you know, that's something that, you know, the characters exist because of the environment that I was living in at that time.
Did you always see yourself as a lyricist as opposed to someone who would write, you know, the music and the lyrics?
Well, before I met Glenn, I was writing music and lyrics, and successfully, as far as I was concerned, for me, as juvenile as some of the ideas were, it was an introduction into becoming the young person that I then became. And when Glenn came along, the reverse, really. He had written some songs, but lyrically he didn't feel like he was strong enough to carry the songs. So he asked me whether we would cross-pollinate lyrics and music together, which we did. And then that became our life for like 50 years,
right?
Strangely enough.
Then did you start off working together on the music and the lyrics and then eventually just sort of separate them?
No. I suppose I would write sometimes 20 lyrics and put them under his door, and then I'd hear him playing the piano, and then a couple of days later I'd hear a couple of songs. So and again, there was no real hard conversation. I was always blessed to hear whatever was written. I was thrilled, you know, when I listen to some of the earlier songs now, which I've been doing recently. I'm astounded at how brilliant they are.
Do you remember the first song you wrote on your own?
Yeah, it's a song called It's Over, and I've been doing it in my solo show just recently, and it still stands up.
Not the same as the It's Over that's on, what, Some Fantastic Place, I think?
No, it's not that one.
Different one.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first one that you and Glenn wrote together?
I do. It was called Hotel Woman, and it was kind of very basic, and it opened, you know, it was the key that opened the door. It wasn't a song to be, you know, to look back and say, wow, that was incredible.
So you've never gone back and said, hey, here's the song we wrote, the first song we ever wrote together, ladies and gentlemen, Hotel Woman.
No. Good Lord.
Were you someone who, were you walking around with like a notebook? Were you sort of always writing? Like how did you, what was your writing process back then?
Well, I got loads of notebooks in this room, and they're all filled with ideas and lyrics that became songs eventually. And, you know, those were the days before the laptop. And, you know, now I can sit with my laptop and write endlessly. I quite enjoy that, just take myself out of my space. But equally, if I'm on a journey somewhere, I can go to my phone and write lyrics down or stories down. You know, I have a really good word processor called IA Writer, and IA Writer is just a blank screen, and you just type onto it and the words appear. It's brilliant.
Wow, that's people should really discover that technology. It sounds like you were pretty prolific if you're sort of slipping 20 songs at a time under Glenn's door. Were the songs that became Squeeze songs the ones that you thought would become Squeeze songs, or were there other ones where maybe you'd write the lyrics and that wouldn't turn into a song?
I really didn't think, to be honest. I just gave Glenn the lyrics, and you know, the tunes would flow, and some of them made the album. I mean, when we made the first album, a lot of the songs didn't make it. You know, so it was just whatever the band could stomach and prove to themselves that we could do.
Well, and it sounded like on the first album, you had John Cale as the producer, and it sounded like he was giving you guys direction that maybe you didn't appreciate and was sort of pushing you in lyrical directions that you didn't really need to be pushed in.
It was challenging, but I'm glad that it happened. I really enjoyed the process looking back at it.
So, but you had like other songs at that point. Did those songs surface later, or were they just kind of tabled for good?
We have two collections of demos from that 1974. One of them has 25 songs on it, and the other one has 13. And the one that has 13 on it is now going to be released next March.
Wow.
So it's because we believe it still sounds good. We just never got to make it at the time.
So these are the demos of what would have been your debut album.
I don't know about debut album, but it was a project. It's an album called Trixies. It's about a nightclub. And yeah, we've just finished it. It's produced by Owen Biddle and Glenn. Owen is our bass player. He's a marvelous chap. And the two of them have made an incredible album.
But this is material that predates the first album?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. How much of an impact in general did producers have on those records? I mean, you had John Cale, John Wood, who'd worked with like Richard and Linda Thompson, and, you know, obviously Elvis Costello, and, you know, moving forward. Like, what was the interaction of, you know, producers and Squeeze?
John Wood was like an uncle to us, really, and Glenn got on with him very well and stayed behind most of the time to work with John on the tracks. Glenn was very passionate and is very passionate about making records. He likes to fine-tune melodies and find out where the song needs to go. He's very detailed in that way, and John Wood was a good partner for him.
And that's on Cool for Cats. I'm just
Cool for Cats and Argy Bargy. And then when we went to the Elvis Costello record on East Side Story, we just allowed Elvis to take over, and thank God that we did, because it was such a brilliant thing for us to have achieved.
Right. And then you had Dave Edmonds on, I think, in Quintessence as well.
Yeah, he's not very well at the moment, so I hear. So I'm sending prayers to Dave. But yeah, I mean, Dave, we'd recorded the first version of Tempted with him, which has never come out.
It was, the first version was faster, right?
It was like ELO.
Why hasn't it come out? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, I don't know why. Well, it's probably because it's not that great.
Because it sounded like ELO. Yeah. I like ELO. I thought of Tempted as an ELO song, but I'll have to like imagine that. Did you have strings on it too?
No.
So something like Label with Love, when you wrote that, did you think that was a country song, or was it surprising to you that that was a country song?
It was surprising and very pleasing to hear the juxtaposition of the lyric and the music. And I mean, thankfully, it was Elvis Costello who really championed the recording of that song. We weren't really that bothered, but he sort of pushed it, and I'm glad that he did.
Oh, so you guys would have maybe left that one off, and he's like, no, you should do this one?
Yeah. He was very vocal about it, as I recall.
Did you always have built in that connection of F-hole and Label with Love, where you have the line about the country songs at the end, and then it goes into the country song?
That was a concept that came up in the compiling of the album, I think. I certainly never had it in my mind, but it's a really good mixture, and we did it live a couple of years ago, and we did exactly that, and it was great.
So I was actually in Nashville it was almost exactly, 3 years ago, 4 years ago? And you played the Ryman, and I think it was the first time you ever played F-Hole live. So yeah. I think it was the first night of that tour, and I was just like, oh, I saw the first ever performance of that. So that was that.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. I really enjoyed playing that song and singing it as well. It's just a great song.
So none of these songs, when you wrote the lyrics, you had no idea like which were going to be the rockers or which were going to be more ballady, anything like that?
No idea. I still don't.
Can you think of any in which, I mean, it's probably happened all the time, but where you were sort of most surprised by how the song came out?
I guess every now and again, I kind of hear a new song and I have to take... It takes my breath away and I have to think about it for a while before I can appreciate the brilliance that is that song. So things like that don't often sink in very quickly with me. If it's a complicated song and it's got a lot of movement chord-wise and melody-wise, it takes me a while to become associated with it, because I don't know why, but my mind just can't cope with it sometimes.
Are you someone who evaluates your work as you're creating it? Like, do you think, oh, this is like a major song, this one I'm not so sure about, or is it really you just produce it and then see what happens?
I think songwriting is all about see what happens. I don't think you can predict where any song is going to go, particularly these days. So, you know, the recording process has changed so much in the last 5 years that it's unrecognizable to the way that it was when I was a kid.
I'm just imagining you writing, say, Pulling Muscles from the Shell, and you probably had no idea that that was going to be like the signature song for your band for decades.
Well, you don't really. And it's when you play it live in the set, it kind of just spins out of control as a song. It just does what it does what it says. But the audiences react to it.
Did you have senses like when you would, you know, record a song, would you think, oh, this one's a hit, you know, I'm going to hear this one on the radio all the time?
No, I've never had that feeling really. Although having said that, you know, I do, when we record a song and I get an emotional buzz from a song, then I feel that it's going to have history, the history of Squeeze, associated with it. And that comes very rarely these days, but, you know, I think when it does happen, it's a prize worth having, that's for sure.
So what are the songs that's happened on?
Well, particularly on the Play album, Walk a Straight Line, The Truth, Letting Go, for me, three of the most emotionally packed songs that we've ever cut. You know, I think they're just amazing songs, and they came at an incredible time.
Are there albums of yours that you particularly like to go back to and maybe don't like to go back to?
I don't ever go back to our catalogue to listen to it unless we're going on tour, and then I listen to it. You know, I find it hard listening to our own songs unless there's work to be done. You know, I'd rather sort of discover other music, I think, because I've already lived that one.
Right. Do you have generally positive associations with the older stuff?
Yeah, there's an emotional journey with every record and every song. So when I do listen to them, I do find myself attached to them. Of course I do. And I love them for that. But it's very rare to go back in and listen to your own music, I think, and unless you're going to go to work and you need to understand what the song was about in the first place. And some of them need rediscovering and some of them don't.
When you would be recording these albums, recording the songs, how did you decide which ones you were going to sing lead on?
I didn't decide, really. I was a shy singer and still am. So it would have normally been, Chris, you should sing this, you know. So I don't think it was ever thought through particularly. I think it was just to have the balance. And I'm very happy with that, and I'm very happy to be the lower octave of Glenn's melody.
Right. I have the deluxe CD edition of Argy Bargy, and there's a version of Glenn singing Someone Else's Heart, which didn't make the album, and it is more of sort of a synthy arrangement, and then obviously it shows up as the second song on East Side Story, and you're singing it. Was that, did like Elvis Costello or someone say, hey, you should sing this one, or how did that happen?
I would imagine it was, I can't remember, but I would imagine it would have been Elvis saying, I think you should sing this. And in fact, his version of it is brilliant. I don't know if you've heard that.
Elvis's version?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I have not heard Elvis's version. I've heard yours and Glenn's, but not Elvis's. I'd love to hear that. Is that out?
You can find it, I'm sure. Yeah.
I'll look for it. Do you remember going back, like the first time you realized that you and Glenn sound awesome singing octaves together?
I guess it would have been when we were kind of almost living together, and we would have mates around, and then we'd sing something together, and it kind of just brought the room into a warm place for me. And I have happy memories of those days. So, yeah, I think it was very early on that it just felt like a comfortable mix.
Yeah. When you're going from Cool for Cats to Argy Bargy to East Side Story, there was kind of this growth from album to album. Was that exciting to be inside of at that point?
I don't remember the journey because it just happened so quickly. You know, the records in those days, you know, you were on the road and then the record company would be looking for the next album, or the manager would be. And then the next thing, you know, you're in the studio making the next album and then you're off on the road. So it was perpetual. It kept on going. And then it didn't. And now it doesn't very often. It's kind of, we are a touring band and we're very good at that. And we don't have a lot of time to record. Because of many reasons, mainly because it costs a lot of money, and also because, you know, people don't really listen to much music these days. They stream it. So it's a different commodity than what it was when we were kids.
Yeah, the album, it's, yeah, I mean, back then, almost all of my favorite groups were, you know, putting out like album at least one a year. I mean, you guys, year after year, Elvis Costello, I mean, sometimes he'd double up even, you know, depending on like, he'd have 20 B-sides that he had to release at the same time too. And it's a different commodity now, although vinyl is back. So the 40-minute album is kind of back in vogue as opposed to in the mid-90s when everyone was making 65-minute CDs at least. But like, I remember when East Side Story was coming out, that was when people were using these Lennon-McCartney comparisons to you guys. Did that mess with your heads? Did that have an impact on the trajectory of Squeeze?
Not for me, really. I kind of, I could see why the record company would take that and run with it, because it looked good on billboards. But, you know, it was, how could we be like them? I mean, they're on a different stratosphere and their songwriting is completely different to ours. But it was lovely.
And it was a different, just different approach to songwriting and everything.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the band as a whole, though, kind of absorbed that pressure of like having to live up to that kind of hype?
No, I don't think anybody did. I've heard Glenn say that he found it tricky, but I can't speak for Glenn. But I don't think the band really, it didn't faze anybody. We just got on with the job of touring.
And you went back to make Sweets from a Stranger, and it was just sort of business as usual at that point, or were there things that were kind of coming up that were more problematic?
We were tired, I would say. We'd been on the road so long, and we'd recorded all those records in a quick succession. So I think there was a strain making that record. There are elements of it that I really love, but When the Hangover Strikes is still one of my favorite songs that we've written. But other than that...
His House, Her Home, that's a great one. I've always loved that.
Yeah, I wish I could find the right key to sing it in. It's a bit higher for me these days.
No, that's there's some great stuff on Sweets from a Stranger. You did not go back to Elvis Costello to produce that record. Is it just because he was busy, or you wanted to sort of move on to, you know, try, what was it, Phil McDonald, who'd worked with the Beatles, did that one?
I don't think there was any need to stick with Elvis. We were off to the next album, off to the next manager, off to the next keyboard player. You know, we were off.
What was the reason behind the fluidity of the band members? I mean, so different bass player. John Bentley came in on Argy Bargy as bass player. Jules left, and Paul Carrick was in for East Side Story, and then Don Snow was in for Sweets from a Stranger on the keyboards. What was the reason for all that kind of movement within the band?
Well, it's hard to say. I think keyboard players are generally songwriters as well, and they have their own careers to foster, and you know, their own paths to follow. And I think that's why keyboard players generally speak and come and go. So yeah, I mean, it was John Bentley was a gift really when he joined Squeeze, and you know, he was there for a long time. So you know, he was always. He was always a great person to have around, a very solid kind of friend.
And then at the end of Sweets from a Stranger, you guys did Annie Get Your Gun. I remember seeing you doing that on Saturday Night Live. And then you broke up and did the Difford and Tilbrook record. I know you've gone over this a lot, but what was kind of the impetus? Was there a sense of you just didn't want it to be a democracy where you and Glenn are 40% of the votes? What was the reason to sort of split off at that point?
Again, we just tired, and we needed to rest. So we broke the band up, but you know, a year later we were back together again. So, you know, we went off and did different things together, but when we got back together, it just felt natural that we should be back on stage, particularly with Jules. You know, it was a small charity gig, I think, that Glenn had organized. And, you know, the next thing we know, we're back at the record company and off and running.
Do you look at the Difford Tilbrook album as being, you know, a Squeeze album in all but name?
I don't know what I think, really. it's a struggle to come up with any description. It was a separation between the two of us at that point, and I think it was a difficult record to make, and I don't think it could have been a Squeeze record, although it sounds like Squeeze in parts. But yet again, it's got some absolutely genius parts to it. You know, Love's Crashing Waves is one of my favorite songs, and Hope Fell Down is I really would love that back in the set.
Right. You guys have played that one fairly recently, or you've had that in the Squeeze set before.
Yeah.
Hope Fell Down. Yeah, it's kind of ironic because it's about the two of you, but it sounds, from what I've read at least, that was sort of a time where, you know, both of you were kind of struggling with stuff, whether it was Substance or whatever. Do you sort of view that period as like, this is like kind of our low point in terms of dealing with each other and struggling with whatever issues you were struggling with?
Quite possibly, yeah. I mean, it had to be there to get to the other side. You know, it's just another stepping stone to the next record, really.
So when you went back to do Cozy Fan Tutti Frutti, were a lot of those issues behind you, or were you still struggling with them?
Personally speaking, I was still struggling, but it was a good record to make. I enjoyed it. I think it's the most dated of the records that we've made sound-wise. But again, there's a couple of really good songs on it, and the performances were very good.
I think it's a really, at the time that album came out, because I was kind of not that into the sort of the 80s sound, quote unquote, like the sort of the synthetic part of it, I was a little taken aback by it, but it's an album I come back to. And I feel like side one is actually kind of just really, you know, I mean, side two is fine too, but I feel like all five songs is like, it actually flows really nicely. I think Big Ben is Bang is great. I think King George Street's one of your best songs. Last Time Forever is really cool. I mean, all of them. I learned How to Pray by Your Side. That's side one. So it's an interesting, it has like that album has a personality to it that's distinct. And at the time, not that you asked, but at the time I was like, wait a minute, this isn't the Squeeze of East Side Story and Sweets from a Stranger. It sounds more 80s, but I come back to that one more often than I would have guessed.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to go back to it.
And then Babylon and On has Hourglass, which turned out to be your biggest hit. Were you surprised that that was such a big hit?
Yeah, but that was MTV for you. MTV really catapulted us around America in a way that no other medium could, I suppose. And we were on it and off it all the time, winning awards and touring in bigger places. And, you know, that was an extraordinary fast time. We were in top gear at that stage of our careers.
And you had a very catchy chorus on that one.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Like, so, and again, when you wrote that one, did you sort of imagine like it's going to have that kind of, you know, sort of rapid fire delivery?
No, I didn't think that. I mean, Glenn and I wrote that in the same room, and we did kind of chop and change the ideas. And, you know, I think for me, the strength of the song is in the production as much as it is the vocal.
So I think what was Eric Thorngren produced that album. He did that. And then Frank, which actually is a pretty different sounding record, but like what kind of impact did he have on what you guys are doing?
Oh, it was wonderful working with Eric. He's just such a lightning color of a person, really great to work with, very imaginative. And he knew his way around an SSL board like nobody else.
Did he push you artistically in any directions? I mean, like Frank, I think I read that you guys recorded most of that live, and it is a more, you know, lively, you know, sounding record than, you know, Babylon and On, which has like great moments on it, but sounds a little more 80s, not as dated sounding as Cozy, but.
Well, it sounds live because we were in a studio that wasn't very good. So we had to kind of get it done, get out of there as quickly as possible.
How'd you feel about like how you were playing as a band at that point? Is there sort of a peak to you on like Squeeze as a band, whether it's a certain lineup or a certain album that you were working on?
Well, They've all been peaks of a different kind, but I would say that the one that we have now is the Matterhorn of all peaks, if you like. We've got a really good band, you know, we play Squeeze extremely well.
The live band that you have right now.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. You guys sounded, again, you sounded fantastic when I saw you. And are you getting that band into the studio anytime soon?
Yeah, that's happening.
Well, what's the plan?
Well, we've got the Trixies record that we wrote in 74, which is coming out in March next year. And then we've got to go in the studio and record new stuff next year. And then we've got touring to come up as usual. It's a pretty creative time, I would say.
So is the Trixies album all of you playing on it?
Yeah.
So you're not putting out like the old demos. You actually recorded all of these older songs.
Yeah, we re-recorded them. Yeah.
Interesting. And the stuff that you're writing now, you have like an album's worth of like a new Squeeze album to come?
Not sure. I'm not sure about that. We did make a start last year, I think it was. And then it had to stop. But I'm sure once we've got the time in the diary, then the focus will come back.
Are you able to get everyone in the same room in the same studio playing together? Because so much of recording now is people kind of shooting tapes to each other electronically and parts to each other. You know, are you able to get that?
No, we like to be in the same room if possible. Everybody does that these days, you know, sending stuff via the internet. I don't think that works with Squeeze very well. It's possible, but... I think we like to be in the room and try and figure out where we're going to go with each song.
Are you and Glenn able to be in the room together when you're working on songs, like the songwriting part of it?
We're in the next room to each other, yeah.
do you now, like, you know, instead of sliding the pages under his door, are you like emailing him stuff or?
I was, yeah, but, you know, there's sometimes we sort of sit in the same room and discuss it and, you know, he'll then disappear around a piano and then you'll hear something coming out. And, you know, I think the thing that I've discovered about us as a writing team is that our ambitions are different in some ways. I'm very much of the opinion of letting this songwriting experience happen and letting it come to you rather than chasing it all the time. I think there's probably merit in both. And I think sometimes Squeeze hits the middle ground and we do a bit of both. And that's when we get our best results.
So Glenn is chasing it more. What does that mean specifically?
He likes to spend a lot of time on production and fine-tuning everything, which he's brilliant at. I mean, I couldn't do that. He likes to be in the studio hour after hour doing that. And I, you know, I recorded my own stuff just last year, and I just said to the musicians that I were using, we've got 7 days, just do whatever you want. These are the songs. I'd like to hear you play them in the way that you would like to play them rather than the way I want you to play them.
Right. I mean, you had your Fancy Pants and Pants project that was pretty recent. Do you have a follow-up to that coming up? And are you working on that stage show that you would love to do at some point?
I've got a musical podcast coming out in September, which is a musical podcast. It's a discussion about the songs that I've wrote during lockdown, the ones that I've just been talking about. And, you know, it's not going to be a hard... physical record because nobody really wants that. So it's kind of a podcast. It's a discussion with a friend of mine about my history in before I met Glenn and Squeeze. So yeah, it's good. I'm proud of it, and it will be coming out in September.
And you're going to perform songs on that as well, then?
I've been doing that already on my solo shows. Yeah,
right. But the podcast is going to be like, it's not just you talking. You're going to also perform on it.
Yeah.
And what's it called?
It's called 50 Years.
You guys took a long break. You did from the cradle to the grave, and the knowledge. Did it feel like you were just kind of picking up where you left off, or was there anything that had changed over the time between those, you know, Domino and Cradle to the Grave?
Lots of things changed. I think we'd grown up in different directions together. And I think the band had changed. The commitment was different. Touring was different. I mean, it was just different. It always is. But I can honestly say that the new album, the Trixies record, doesn't feel like any of those things that we've been talking about. It feels like a unique experience.
No, I look forward to hearing it. Squeeze always, like, there were, as we talked about before, there were always kind of some shifts going on in the personnel. Was there a point where you and Glenn just finally said, look, we're Squeeze and whoever plays with us is Squeeze, but it's Squeeze is different in Tilbrook plus whoever's playing with us? And does that change things when you're kind of in control as opposed to, you know, having that more like democracy band feel that you had in the earlier days?
I don't think we ever had a democracy, to be absolutely honest. And I don't think we have one now. I think I'm very happy to not allow, but to let Glenn sort of go with what he feels is right for the songs, because he's composed them. I'm the lyricist, he's the composer, and he probably has a more in-depth feel of how they should go. So, you know, I feel lyrically in a strong place at the moment, and that's kind of good at my age.
Tell me about also the other people that you've worked with. Like, you worked with Amy Mann. What did you take out of that experience of you know, singing and playing on her album and seeing how she works, and other people for that matter?
Well, it was a delight to tour with Amy and to record with her. It was beautiful to be asked, and I'm a massive fan of her lyric writing and her songs. So that was a genius time for me. I was very pleased. But yeah, I mean, I like writing with other people and performing with other people, and I do it quite a lot. So it's something that keeps me going.
Is there anyone who's particularly inspired you in some way or made you look at what you were doing and approach it a little bit differently?
I think everybody that you sit down with throws you in a different way, a different direction. If you're listening, then there's a result. You know, you've got to be able to listen to be part of the game, and to respond and respect what other people want from the song that you're trying to write. So it should be a team effort. It should be something that everybody walks away with feeling like, yeah, I've won. Everybody should win the match.
Right. How did you end up doing Boy with a Problem with Elvis Costello, which ended up on Imperial Bedroom?
He just asked me over dinner one night, and I dropped my knife and fork. I couldn't believe he was going to ask me to do that. And I went home and wrote it the next day. So
he actually asked, he said, I would love to record a song that you wrote the lyrics for.
Yeah, absolutely. Over dinner. I remember it really well.
Wow. Was that when you were working on East Side Story? Because the timeline would be about right.
Yeah, it was before that, I think. Yeah.
That's interesting, because he's such a, you know, his lyrics are so distinct. And then there's one song where, you know, he co-wrote with you. And I don't know if he'd co-written with anyone up to that point.
No, I don't think so. No.
So did you just give him lyrics? Did you work with him on it? He's put out, like, you know, a demo version of that song, and it's a little bit different from what he finally recorded. Did you sort of work on the revisions together, or how did that whole thing work?
Yeah, we worked on a small amount of revisions, but there weren't many. It was kind of, you know, just very, very Elvis, very driven. Very brilliant.
Yeah. What is your sort of artistic routine like now? Do you have like a certain time of day that you sit down with a notebook? Do you sort of take walks and have ideas come to you and then put them in your phone? Like, how does it work for you now?
Well, it's different every day, really. My structure is changing. I do like discipline, but I've not been able to get that this year because I've been on tour quite a lot. But normally discipline would be to sit at my desk where I am now and write and see what happens. But I do enjoy the laptop and sit downstairs in a nice comfy chair and just see what happens. And if nothing happens, then I'll go and water the garden, which is what I'm about to do.
There you go. And you're still sort of approaching it from sort of the emotional storytelling point of view. Like that's something that hasn't changed over your 50 years.
No, I want to be a storyteller. I don't want to be an investigator.
There you go. Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. I'm really glad I got to talk to you. That's all for episode 192 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Chris Difford for providing so much insight into his work with one of my favorite bands, Squeeze. If you'd like to hear more from Difford's point of view, his 2017 memoir, Some Fantastic Plays, remains widely available and is packed with revealing stories. He also has released several solo albums, including 2008's The Last Temptation of Chris and 2018's Pants, the single CD version of his Fancy Pants radio play. If you're in England, be sure to catch one of Difford's solo shows. He has many dates scheduled in September, October, and November. Go to chrisdifford.com for more information. And go to squeezeofficial.com to learn about the band's November 15th festival appearance in Barcelona and its December UK tour with Madness. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who knows how to make sense out of mumbo jumbo. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.